Good evening. You're listening to KRBD Ketchikan and reading the classics. This is the time that your Ketchikan Public Library staff will read you some of our classic tales. And tonight, I am truly delighted to be reading you my favorite Edgar Allan Poe story. It's The Cask of Amontillado. It was published originally in November 1846. It is the first of his stories that I ever heard as a girl, and it remains my favorite of his. It has a bit of a dark twist at the end, and I think it's rather delicious. There are lots of theories where Poe got his inspiration for this work, including it being a response to a rival named Thomas Dunn English, who had mocked Poe. And some others say that it was something that he wrote about the dangers of getting too intoxicated, because there was a bit of a temperance movement happening at that time. But rather than go down that rabbit hole any further, I will read to you this story. It is The Cask of Amontillado by Edgar Allan Poe. The thousand injuries of Fortunato I had borne as best I could, but when he ventured upon insult, I vowed revenge. You, who so well know the nature of my soul, will not suppose, however, that I gave utterance to a threat. At length I would be avenged. This was a point definitely settled. But the very definitiveness with which it was resolved precluded the idea of risk. I must not only punish, but punish with impunity. A wrong is unredressed when retribution overtakes its redresser. It is equally unredressed when the avenger fails to make himself felt as such to him who has done the wrong. It must be understood that neither by word nor deed had I given Fortunato cause to doubt my goodwill. I continued, as was my wont, to smile in his face, and he did not perceive that my smile now was at the thought of his immolation. He had a weak point, this Fortunato, although in other regards he was a man to be respected and even feared. He prided himself on his connoisseurship in wine. Few Italians have the true virtuoso spirit. For the most part, their enthusiasm is adopted to suit the time and opportunity, to practice imposture upon the British and Austrian millionaires. In painting and gemmery, Fortunato, like his countrymen, was a quack, but in the matter of old wines he was sincere. In this respect, I did not differ from him materially. I was skillful in the Italian vintages myself, and bought largely whenever I could. It was about dusk one evening during the supreme madness of the carnival season that I encountered my friend. He accosted me with excessive warmth, for he had been drinking much. The man wore motley. He had on a tight-fitting party-striped dress, and his head was surmounted by the conical cap and bells. I was so pleased to see him that I thought I should never have been done wringing his hand. I said to him, "My dear Fortunato, you are luckily met. How remarkably well you are looking today. But I have received a pipe of what passes for Amontillado, and I have my doubts." "How?" said he. "Amontillado? A pipe? Impossible. And in the middle of the carnival?" "I have my doubts," I replied. "And I was silly enough to pay the full Amontillado price without consulting you in the matter. You were not to be found, and I was fearful of losing a bargain." "Amontillado?" "I have my doubts." "Amontillado? And I must satisfy them." "Amontillado? As you are engaged, I am on my way to Lucchesi. If anyone has a critical turn, it is he. He will tell me." "Lucchesi cannot tell Amontillado from sherry." "And yet some fools will have it that his taste is a match for your own."
"Come, let us go."
"Whither?"
"To your vaults."
"My friend, no. I will not impose upon your good nature. I perceive that you have an engagement. Lucchesi..."
"I have no engagement. Come."
"My friend, no. It is not the engagement, but the severe cold with which I perceive that you are afflicted. The vaults are insufferably damp. They are encrusted with nitre."
"Let us go, nevertheless. The cold is merely nothing. Amontillado! You have been imposed upon, and as for Lucchesi, he cannot distinguish sherry from Amontillado."
Thus speaking, Fortunato possessed himself of my arm. Putting on a mask of black silk, and drawing a roquelaire closely about my person, I suffered him to hurry me to my palazzo. There were no attendants at home. They had absconded to make merry in honor of the time.
I had told them that I should not return until the morning, and had given them explicit orders not to stir from the house. These orders were sufficient, I well know, to ensure their immediate disappearance, one and all, as soon as my back was turned. I took from their sconces two flambeaux, and giving one to Fortunato, bowed him through several suites of rooms to the archway that led into the vaults. I passed down a long and winding staircase, requesting him to be cautious as he followed. We came at length to the foot of the descent, and stood together on the damp ground of the catacombs of the Montresors. The gait of my friend was unsteady, and the bells upon his cap jingled as he strode. "The pipe," he said. "It is farther on," said I, "but observe the white webwork which gleams from these cavern walls." He turned toward me and looked into my eyes with two filmy orbs that distilled the rheum of intoxication.
"Nitre?" he asked at length.
"Nitre," I replied. "How long have you had that cough?" My poor friend found it impossible to reply for many minutes.
"It is nothing," he said at last.
"Come," I said, with decision. "We will go back. Your health is precious. You are rich, respected, admired, beloved. You are happy as I once was. You are a man to be missed. For me, it is no matter. We will go back. You will be ill, and I cannot be responsible. Besides, there is Lucchesi."
"Enough," he said. "The cough is a mere nothing. It will not kill me. I shall not die of a cough."
"True, true," I replied, "and indeed, I had no intention of alarming you unnecessarily, but you should use all proper caution. A draught of this Medoc will defend us from the damps." Here I knocked off the neck of a bottle which I drew from a long row of its fellows that lay upon the mould. "Drink," I said, presenting him the wine. He raised it to his lips with a leer. He paused and nodded to me familiarly while his bells jingled.
"I drink," he said, "to the buried that repose around us."
"And I to your long life." He again took my arm, and we proceeded.
"These vaults," he said, "are extensive."
"The Montresors," I replied, "were a great and numerous family."
"I forget your arms."
"A huge human foot d'or in a field azure. The foot crushes a serpent rampant whose fangs are embedded in the heel."
"And the motto?"
"Nemo me impune lacessit."
"Good," he said.
The wine sparkled in his eyes and the bells jingled. My own fancy grew warm with the Medoc. We had passed through the walls of piled bones with casks and puncheons intermingling into the inmost recesses of the catacombs. I paused again, and this time I made bold to seize Fortunato by an arm above the elbow. "The nitre," I said, "see, it increases. It hangs like moss upon the vaults. We are below the river's bed. The drops of moisture trickle among the bones. Come, we will go back ere it is too late. Your cough..."
"It is nothing," he said. "Let us go on. But first, another draught of the Medoc."
I broke and reached him a flacon of de Grave. He emptied it at a breath. His eyes flashed with a fierce light. He laughed and threw the bottle upwards with a gesticulation I did not understand. I looked at him in surprise. He repeated the movement,
a grotesque one. "You do not comprehend," he said.
"Not I," I replied.
"Then you are not of the Brotherhood."
"How?"
"You are not of the Masons."
"Yes, yes," I said. "Yes, yes."
"You, impossible, a Mason?"
"A Mason," I replied.
"A sign," he said.
"It is this," I answered, producing a trowel from beneath the folds of my roquelaire.
"You jest," he exclaimed, recoiling a few paces, "but let us proceed to the Amontillado."
"Be it so," I said, replacing the tool beneath the cloak and again offering him my arm. He leaned upon it heavily. We continued our route in search of the Amontillado. We passed through a range of low arches, descended, passed on, and descending again, arrived at a deep crypt in which the foulness of the air caused our flambeau rather to glow than flame. At the most remote end of the crypt, there appeared another less spacious. Its walls had been lined with human remains, piled to the vault overhead in the fashion of the great catacombs of Paris. Three sides of this interior crypt were still ornamented in this manner. From the fourth, the bones had been thrown down and lay promiscuously upon the earth, forming at one point a mound of some size. Within the wall thus, exposed by the displacing of bones, we perceived a still interior recess in depth of about 4 feet, in width 3, in height 6 or 7. It seemed to have been constructed for no especial use in itself, but formed merely the interval between two of the colossal supports of the roof of the catacombs, and was backed by one of their circumscribing walls of solid granite. It was in vain that Fortunato, uplifting his dull torch, endeavored to pry into the depths of the recess. Its termination the feeble light did not enable us to see. "Proceed," I said. "Herein is the Amontillado. As for Luchesi..." "He is an ignoramus," interrupted my friend as he stepped unsteadily forward, while I followed immediately at his heels. In an instant he had reached the extremity of the niche, and, finding his progress arrested by the rock, stood stupidly bewildered. A moment more, and I had fettered him to the granite. In its surface were two iron staples, distant from each other of about 2 feet horizontally. From one of these depended a short chain, from the other a padlock. Throwing the links about his waist, it was but the work of a few seconds to secure it. He was too much astounded to resist. Withdrawing the key, I stepped back from the recess. "Pass your hand," I said, "over the wall. You cannot help feeling the nitre. Indeed, it is very damp. Once more, let me implore you to return." "No? Then I must positively leave you. But I must first render you all the little attentions in my power." "The Amontillado!" ejaculated my friend, not yet recovered from his astonishment. "True," I replied, "the Amontillado." As I said these words, I busied myself among the pile of bones of which I have before spoken. Throwing them aside, I soon uncovered a quantity of building stone and mortar. With these materials and the aid of my trowel, I began vigorously to wall up the entrance of the niche. I had scarcely laid the first tier of my masonry when I discovered that the intoxication of Fortunato had in great measure worn off. The earliest indication I had of this was a low, moaning cry from the depths of the recess. It was not the cry of a drunken man. There was then a long and obstinate silence. I laid the second tier, and the third, and the fourth, and then I heard the furious vibrations of the chain. The noise lasted for several minutes, during which, that I might hearken to it with the most satisfaction, I would cease my labors and sit down upon the bones. When at last the clanking subsided, I resumed the trowel and finished without interruption the fifth, the sixth, and the seventh tier. The wall was nearly upon a level with my breast. I again paused, and holding the flambeau over the masonwork, threw a few feeble rays upon the figure within. A succession of loud and shrill screams bursting suddenly from the throat of the chained form seemed to thrust me violently back. For a brief moment I hesitated. I trembled. Unsheathing my rapier, I began to grope with it about the recess. But the thought of an instant reassured me. I placed my hand upon the solid fabric of the catacombs and felt satisfied. I reproached the wall. I replied to the yells of him who clamored. I re-echoed. I aided. I surpassed them in volume and in strength. I did this, and the clamor grew still. It was now midnight, and my task was drawing to a close. I had completed the eighth, the ninth, and the tenth tier. I had finished a portion of the last and the eleventh. There remained but a single stone to be fitted and plastered in. I struggled with its weight. I placed it partially in its destined position. But now there came from out the niche a low laugh that erected the hairs upon my head. It was succeeded by a sad voice, which I had difficulty in recognizing as that of the noble Fortunato. The voice said,
A very good joke indeed, an excellent jest. We will have many a rich laugh about it at the palazzo, over our wine.
The Amontillado, I said.
Yes, the Amontillado, but is it not getting late? Will they not be awaiting us at the palazzo? The Lady Fortunato and the rest? Let us be gone.
Yes, I said, let us be gone.
For the love of God, Montresor.
Yes, I said, for the love of God. But to these words I hearkened in vain for a reply. I grew impatient. I called aloud, Fortunato! No answer. I called again, Fortunato! No answer still. I thrust a torch through the remaining aperture and let it fall within. There came forth in return only a jingling of the bells. My heart grew sick on account of the dampness of the catacombs. I hastened to make an end of my labor. I forced the last stone into its position. I plastered it up. Against the new masonry, I re-erected the old rampart of bones. For the half century, no mortal has disturbed them. In pace requiescat. And those final words of our friend was, may he rest in peace. And so that was the Cask of Amontillado.
And now for something completely different. At the Gate by Myla Jo Closser. A shaggy Airedale scented his way along the high road. He had not been there before, but he was guided by the trail of his brethren who had preceded him. He had gone unwillingly upon this journey, yet with the perfect training of dogs he had accepted it without complaint. The path had been lonely, and his heart would have failed him, traveling as he must without his people, had not these traces of countless dogs before him promised companionship of a sort at the end of the road. The landscape had appeared arid at first, for the translation from recent agony into freedom from pain had been so numbing in its swiftness that it was some time before he could fully appreciate the pleasant dog country through which he was crossing. There were woods with leaves upon the ground through which to scurry, long grassy slopes for extended runs, and lakes into which he might plunge for sticks and bring them back to. But he did not complete his thought, for the boy was not with him. A little wave of homesickness possessed him. It made his mind easier to see far ahead a great gate as high as the heavens, wide enough for all. He understood that only man built such barriers, and by straining his eyes, he fancied he could discern humans passing through to whatever lay beyond. He broke into a run that he might the more quickly gain this enclosure, made beautiful by men and women. But his thoughts outran his pace, and he remembered that he had left the family behind, and again this lovely new compound became not perfect, since it would lack the family. The scent of the dogs grew very strong now, and coming nearer, he discovered, to his astonishment, that of the myriads of those who had arrived ahead of him, thousands were still gathered on the outside of the portal. They sat in a wide circle, spreading out on each side of the entrance. Big, little, curly, handsome, mongrel, thoroughbred dogs, of every age, complexion, and personality. All were apparently waiting for something, someone, and at the pad of the Airedale's feet on the hard road, they arose and looked in his direction. That the interest passed as soon as they discovered the newcomer to be a dog puzzled him. In his former dwelling place, a four-footed brother was greeted with enthusiasm when he was a friend, with suspicious diplomacy when a stranger, and with sharp reproof when an enemy, but never had he been utterly ignored. He remembered something that he had read many times on great buildings with lofty entrances. Dogs not admitted, the signs had said, and he feared this might be the reason for the waiting circle outside the gate. It might be that this noble portal stood as the dividing line between mere dogs and humans. but he had been a member of the family, romping with them in the living room, sitting at meals with them in the dining room, going upstairs at night with them, and the thought that he was to be kept out would be unendurable. He despised the passive dogs. They should be treating a barrier after the fashion of their old country, leaping against it, barking, and scratching the nicely painted door. He bounded up the last little hill to set them an example, for he was still full of the rebellion of the world. But he found no door to leap against. He could see beyond the entrance dear masses of people, yet no dog crossed the threshold. They continued in their patient ring, their gaze upon the winding road. He now advanced cautiously to examine the gate. It occurred to him that it must be fly time in this region, and he did not wish to make himself ridiculous before all these strangers by trying to bolt through an invisible mesh like the one that had baffled him when he was a little chap. Yet there were no screens, and despair entered his soul. What bitter punishment these poor beasts must have suffered before they learned to stay on this side of the arch that led to human beings. What had they done on earth to merit this? Stolen bones troubled his conscience, runaway days, sleeping in the best chair until the key clicked in the lock. These were sins. At that moment, an English bull terrier, white with liver-colored spots in a jaunty manner, approached him, snuffling in a friendly way. No sooner had the bull terrier smelt his collar than he fell to expressing his joy at meeting him. The Airedale's reserve was quite thawed by this welcome, though he did not know just what to make of it. "I know you, I know you," exclaimed the bull terrier, adding inconsequently, "What's your name?" "Tam O'Shanter. They call me Tammy," was the answer, with a pardonable break in the voice. "I know them," said the bull terrier. "Nice folks." "Best ever," said the Airedale, trying to be nonchalant and scratching a flea which was not there. "I don't remember you. When did you know them?" "About 14 tags ago, when they were first married. We keep track of time here by the license tags. I had 4. "This is my first and only one. You were before my time, I guess." He felt young and shy. "Come for a walk and tell me all about them," was his new friend's invitation. "Aren't we allowed in there?" asked Tam, looking toward the gate. "Sure. You can go in whenever you want to. Some of us do at first, but we don't stay."
"Like it better outside?"
"No, no, it isn't that."
"Then why are all you fellows hanging around here? Any old dog can see it's better beyond the arch."
"You see, we're waiting for our folks to come."
The Airedale grasped it at once and nodded understandingly. "I felt that way when I came along the road. It wouldn't be what it's supposed to be without them. It wouldn't be the perfect place."
"Not to us," said the bull terrier.
"Fine, I've stolen bones, but it must be that I've been forgiven if I'm to see them here again. It's the great good place, all right. But look here," he added, as a new thought struck him. "Do they wait for us?"
The older inhabitant coughed in slight embarrassment. "The humans couldn't do that very well. It wouldn't be the thing to have them hang around outside for just a dog. Not dignified."
"Quite right," agreed Tam. "I'm glad they go straight to their mansions. I'd hate to have them missing me as I am missing them." He sighed. "But then, they wouldn't have to wait so long."
"Oh, well, they're getting on. Don't be discouraged," comforted the terrier. "And in the meantime, it's like a big hotel in summer, watching the new arrivals. See, there's something doing now."
All the dogs were aroused to excitement by a little figure making its way uncertainly up the last slope. Half of them started to meet it, crowding around in a loving, eager pack.
"Look out! Don't scare it!" cautioned the older animals, while word was passed to those farthest from the gate. "Quick, quick! A baby's come!"
Before they had entirely assembled, however, a gaunt yellow hound pushed through the crowd, gave one sniff at the small child, and with a yelp of joy crouched at its feet. The baby embraced the hound in recognition, and the two moved toward the gate. Just outside, the hound stopped to speak to an aristocratic Saint Bernard, who had been friendly.
"Sorry to leave you, old fellow," he said, "but I'm going to watch over the kid. You see, I'm all she has up here."
The bull terrier looked at the Airedale for appreciation.
"That's the way we do it," he said proudly.
"Yes, but..." The Airedale put his head on one side in perplexity.
"Yes, but what?" asked the guide.
"The dogs that don't have any people. The nobody's dogs."
"That's the best of all. Oh, everything is thought out here. Crouch down, you must be tired, and watch," said the bull terrier.
Soon they spied another small form making the turn in the road. He wore a Boy Scout's uniform, but he was a little fearful for all that, so new was this adventure. The dogs rose again and snuffled, but the better groomed of the circle held back, and in their place a pack of odds and ends of the company ran down to meet him. The Boy Scout was reassured by their friendly attitude, and after petting them impartially, he chose an old-fashioned black and tan, and the two passed in. Tam looked questioningly.
"They didn't know each other," he exclaimed.
"But they've always wanted to. That's one of the boys who used to beg for a dog, but his father wouldn't let him have one. So all our strays wait for just such little fellows to come along. Every boy gets a dog, and every dog gets a master."
"I expect the boy's father would like to know that now," commented the Airedale. "No doubt he thinks quite often, 'I wished I'd let him have a dog.'"
The bull terrier laughed. "You're pretty near the earth yet, aren't you?"
Tam admitted it.
"I've a lot of sympathy with fathers and with boys, having both of them in the family, and a mother as well."
The bull terrier leaped up in astonishment. "You don't mean to say they keep a boy?"
"Sure, greatest boy on earth. 10 this year."
"Well, well, this is news. I wish they'd kept a boy when I was there."
The Airedale looked at his new friend intently.
"See here, who are you?" he demanded. But the other hurried on. "I used to run away from them just to play with a boy. They'd punish me, and I always wanted to tell them that it was their fault for not getting one."
"Who are you, anyway?" repeated Tam, taking all this interest in me, too. "Whose dog were you?"
"You've already guessed. I see it in your quivering snout. I'm the old dog that had to leave them about 10 years ago."
"Their old dog, Bully?"
"Yes, I'm Bully." They nosed each other with deeper affection, then strolled about the glade shoulder to shoulder. Bully the more eagerly pressed for news. "Tell me, how are they getting along?"
"Very well indeed. They've paid for the house."
I suppose you occupy the kennel."
"No, they couldn't stand it to see another dog in your old place."
Bully stopped to howl gently. "That touches me. It's generous in you to tell it. To think they missed me."
For a little while they went on in silence, but as evening fell, and the light from the golden streets inside the city gave the only glow to the scene, Bully grew nervous and suggested that they go back.
"We can't see so well at night, and I like to be pretty close to the path, especially toward morning."
Tam assented.
"And I will point them out. You might not know them just at first."
"Oh, we know them. Sometimes the babies have grown up, so they're rather hazy in their recollection of how we look. They think we're bigger than we are, but you can't fool us dogs."
"It's understood," Tam cunningly arranged, "that when he or she arrives, you'll sort of make them feel at home while I wait for the boy."
"That's the best plan," asserted Bully kindly. "And if by any chance the little fellow should come first, there's been a lot of them this summer, of course you'll introduce me."
"I shall be proud to do it." And so, with muzzles sunk between their paws and with their eyes straining down the pilgrim's road, they wait outside the gate. The end.
Thank you for listening to KRBD's Reading the Classics, and have a good evening.